Accession number 30267, Reel 1.
Yes, and this is Joe Patient, and it's Reel 1. And as I threatened Joe, I'm going to ask you first of all about your family background. Whereabouts were you born and brought up?
I was born in Southwark, SE1, London SE1, and in a very, very nice house. Very secluded house, really, but only less than 100 yards to some of the worst slums in London. But it's amazing. My father was well thought of, a hard working man. He worked for 40 years for the same brewery, Barclay Perkins, and he got my brother's apprenticeships there, but refused to get me one because I would let the family name down. I was my father didn't think a very great deal of me, and although I respected my father, I never loved him, but I adored my mother. And this had a great effect on my life later on. For example, shortly before I was 14, I left school. I shouldn't have done, but I did it on my own volition. And when this was found out, of course, my father obviously found out, because the school board man came and asked my mother where I'd been, and says, well, he goes to school every day. And I think what upset my mother, she used to give me sixpence to go to school, with two tuppenny rolls, ham, corned beef or what have you, a penny for a cup of tea, and a penny for myself. Quite frequently, tuppence or threepence or even fourpence would go into the slot machines for Joe, and Joe would go hungry. But there was a very interesting thing about this. I fell foul of my French master, a man called Jenkins. And he was one of the cruelest persons I've ever come across. And he, on one occasion, asked me to conjugate some verb in the past participle. And I just looked at him blankly, because I hadn't a clue what past participle meant. So how devil could I conjugate anything with it, you see? And he took it for insolence and sent me for the cane. And he gave me a six on each hand. And he used to aim for the tip of the finger. He really was cruel about this. And if he missed, it didn't count as one of the six. It was really... Anyway, it came to the point that when there was a French lesson on, I used to skip school. And on one of the occasions I skipped school, I met a girl called Nancy. And she was a little older than I, and was kept at home looking after her mother's other children, so that her mother could go to work, etc. So she was used as a flunky, really. But I liked her, and I arranged to meet her on one of these afternoons. So I went without my sixpence, and we went to the pictures, in the afternoon. The two of us would go for my lunch. And this, I got very fond of her, and I don't think I ever kissed the girl, ever. But we used to walk hand in hand and walk over one bridge and along the embankment and back around the other bridge and so on. So, her name was Maggie Parr. And, of course, she was from the buildings. And the working class snobbery was my father, who was... I should never play with children from the buildings.
What were the buildings?
the buildings were these new high-rise tenants that were put up in the 30s.
And this would have been near the Imperial War Museum, wouldn't it?
No, that's quite a way off.
Oh, is it?
No, this was in Great Dover Street.
Oh, I know. Yes.
It leads from St. George's Church to the Blackfriars.
That's right, yes. And you were in the vicinity, weren't you?
Yes.
What is now the Imperial War Museum?
No. I went to school.
Went to school there, yes.
But no, we were quite. It was quite a long walk from.
No, I think the school you went to was.
Rockingham Street was the elementary school.
Yes.
And then I won a scholarship, and so I had an interview at St. Olive's College, they asked me questions about my father and et cetera, and family. And I think it was, in a way, kindness on their part that they didn't accept me because they didn't think that my family could afford the books and the clothes, etc. So I was put off to the Southwark Central, which was then known, West Square. It was called Southwark Central at that time.
So that is the connection with the Imperial War Museum.
That's right, yes. Because we used to look out of the on the upstairs windows at the school. You could look over into the ground, directly over into the grounds of the what used to be then called Bedlam. It wasn't the Royal Museum then, it was the Bedlam. And you would see some of the chaps walking around and various antics they would play. And I felt very sorry for them. Some of my other chaps at school would poke fun, and I'd have a bit of a row about that. So that anyway, it was a good schooling, except for this French fellow. So I left school virtually on one of my afternoons when Maggie wasn't present. I walked along the Jamaica Road. It's just by Tower Bridge Road. And there was a firm called there Perrin & Melcher, furniture makers, used to make furniture for the Times Furnishing Company. And there was a notice outside, woodworkers wanted. And I was fairly useful with my hands. And I applied for a job, and they told me to start on Monday. Well, now, this presented a problem, because I used to go to my first week's wages. I bought myself a pair of long trousers. In those days, you'd see boys 17 and even 18 around still in shorts at that time, and you only had a pair of long trousers if you went to work. But the amusing part was I used to have to take these long trousers off over my shorts and poke them into one of the sand bins that was alongside the road those days, which for the icy weather, etc. Until eventually the school board man came round, and I think what upset my mother, she very, very seldom hit me at all, ever, but there was no need. All they need to say is, well, I'll tell your father, and that was that. My father was a very, very strict Victorian sort of man. No grey areas. It was only black and white. If he said, be in at seven you were okay. 2 minutes passed and you got a good hiding. But there you are. That was he. I felt then, I suppose, like any young boy does, that as I went to work and... Oh, incidentally, when my father found out and I was getting 12 shillings a week, 12 and sixpence a week at that time, he said, well, right, in future, you will give your mother 10 shillings and you can have 2 shillings and sixpence for yourself. Which have been the norm at the time, but up to that 2 or 3 weeks before they found out I was working, I had, of course, the whole 12 and sixpence to myself. But as luck would have it, I bought tools with it. I didn't waste it. I bought tools with it. And had I not, I told my father, and he said, you bring the tools home to show me. That's how much he believed me. And had I not had them, I would have really had a good hiding, I know, but I brought the children and he was satisfied. But then I felt that I shouldn't have to do a lot of the chores that I was made to do up to that point. I was now out earning, or thinking to myself I was earning a living, and I got very, very uptight about this. So much so that I upset my father on one occasion, and I remember his words very clearly. "The only time your mother and I have words is over you, you little bugger." And as I adored my mother so much, I felt badly, and I thought, well, I'll do something about this. And I left and I went over to the West End, and I got myself a job at the Young Women's Christian Association at 12 Grosvenor Place. This was, of course, debutance, as a page boy. And for that, I got 5 shillings a week, but of course, I lived in. And that the work was mostly scrubbing the and whitening these many steps that led up to this august sort of accommodation at about 6:30 in the morning. The only time we prayed to rain, then we didn't have to do the steps. It was there I started to learn to dance. One of the housemaids there was a very keen dancer, and she taught me a very great deal about dancing and other things as well. However, most of my time, spare time, was spent in Hyde Park, and on a Sunday at Speaker's Corner, which was very educational.
Who were the speakers at that time?
All sorts of speakers they had. A very great deal religious, political, raving lunatics. And there was one, it was a standing joke really, there was one who repeated every Sunday. He came out with exactly the same words, and he would start a sentence and we would all finish the sentence for him. That's how well he was known. But it was very interesting. That was part of my education, and of course I then started to lose, by aping my betters, I started to lose what Cockney accent I had. And I it is through my working in the West End, right the way from 14 and a half to when I joined de Havilland's, which would be when I was 22. And living and working in the West End during that period of time, I, if you like, lost whatever Cockney accent I had, and of course learnt table manners and various other way a table was set and what fork and knife to use and etc., so I could pass muster in any company after that.
You would have been born, I think, Joe, towards the end of the Great War.
Yes,
you?
1917.
Yes. Did that impinge in any way on your life as
no.
you were growing up?
No.
Did you get the effects of that?
Not really. I didn't, and not knowledgeably. I had a little experience at a young age of the Jarrow marches, and particularly the Welsh miners who came and sang, walked round with their immaculately clean but very worn clothes and boots, and I admired them very, very much.
Did you see the Jarrow marches?
Yes, I was only a young lad, but I saw them. But then I remember And I remember with fondness, it's sad the children of today couldn't see. To see the fire engine being drawn by six horses galloping down the street with the brass helmets on the firemen and so on, so resplendent. It really is was an amazing sight. And of course those days the buses that we went on had solid tyres.
A different world.
And of course we had the trams, which were a great benefit. In those early days you could go almost anywhere in London and all over London by tram, provided you have the pennies to put in.
As you were growing up, you know, and taking on your different jobs,
well, I can pretty well go through them. I think I had 20 jobs before I was 21. Although I beat the sack in one or two of the places of the by resigning, I was never out of work more than a week.
And this
I always found found another job.
Yes.
Yeah. The there was one particular job that I was a commis waiter at Ojad and de Gourmet in Greek Street, and Charles Lawton used to eat there very frequently, and it was the only place that I not the only place, it was a place where they used to have an alive trout swimming around in a thing. And it was amusing to me because the only way the customer would select a trout, and you would take it out in the net and take it downstairs, and it was immediately put into another bowl of water, another glass, and the chap got served with a trout that hadn't been selected by him. The only way they could be assured of having the trout that they chose was if they ordered it as throat blue trout, and that is only because you can't get a blue trout unless you dip it into the boiling water while it's still alive. So
that's a good tip. When I order a fresh trout.
The only other thing I remember so clearly about the Jardin du Gourmet was the I dropped a commis pear, and of course it bruised, and the head waiter wanted me to charge me 2 shillings and 6 pence, which was the price of the pear on the menu. I said, that's nonsense. I said, I'll go down the road to Frith Street and buy one for threepence. But then of course they used to operate the tronc system, TRONC, which was supposedly a share out between all the staff. The head waiter took probably about 90% of it, and as you went down the line, so you got a little bit if you were lucky. Which meant that sometimes when there was a tip left, and there was nobody to see you put it in your pocket, perhaps there might have been 2 shillings there, and you slip a shilling in your own pocket and put another shilling into the trunk. The living was hard, and so you had to try to make amends, even if it meant being dishonest at times. One rather interesting experience was when I worked both as a waiter at L'Ecu de France in German Street, very upmarket restaurant, and it was owned by a Frenchman who also owned the Lan Rouge in Paris. As a part-time, I used to have to attend to the telephone exchange system, and it was one of these plug-in and plug-out, very, very difficult to manipulate. And on one occasion, I received a call from Paris, and put me through to the chef. It was the boss, and unfortunately, I pulled the wrong plug or put in the wrong plug, and he didn't get through. Put through. Eventually, he got back to me. He was so abusive to me that I knew that I was going to get the sack anyway. So I said, "Oh bollocks," and pulled the plug out on him. So I went to the head waiter. I said, "Look, I've got a bit of a problem here. I said, I've only got 2 days' wages to come." And I told him what had happened. And he said, "Well," he said, "I daren't give you it." I said, "Oh, well, in bollocks to you too," and walked out. So I went up to Frith Street, where I went down into the billiard saloon there. And I had previously had a job as a billiards marker, and I could play billiards and snooker very, very well at a young age. I occasionally used to earn a shilling or two by pretending I couldn't play well, and then suddenly I got a flash of inspiration. But these were the sort of things you were pretty well forced to do if you wanted to make anything.
What was it that led you to de Havilland's? I think we ought to get on to going into the war.
Well, the main jobs that I had, I worked at, the principal jobs I had was, I was a head marker at the Oriental Club, and I was at the Oriental Club when I got married. And the secretary was Sir Alfred Pickford, who gave me one of the old £5 white, big white notes as a wedding present, that remember. And then I went to the Arts Club in Dover Street, which was a more enjoyable job, but as, again, a head billiard marker. And I was in this job when a friend of mine who I didn't know it at the time, but whose wife was virtually actually on the game in the West End. I didn't know it. I had three nicknames at that time. I had Fluxite. They used to call me Fluxite because my ears stuck out, and if there was a Fluxite and Solder was a little tin, and it showed a man with two big ears. And then I was called the Primitive Methodist because I very seldom swore. This chap who introduced me to de Havilland's, who offered to me his, suggested I went to work there and offered to let me have his toolkit so I could go there as a fitter. And he, Bob, his name was, he used to write poetry. And the little bit about Joe was Fluxite gone in off the green, biggest Burke you've ever seen. This is what they used to think of me. I was a primitive, really, I was a primitive Methodist. I was quite not streetwise at that time. However, I went to de Havilland's, and I told them that I had been working at Frigidaire, which was a lie, of course. And 3 weeks went by, and I got on with the job, and I was called into the office, and I said, "We had a reply from Frigidaire." I said, "Well, which department did you apply to?" So I said, "Well, I wasn't in that. I was in the other, the erection department." Anyway, about 3 weeks went by and I was sent for again. And I said, he said, patient, you lied to me. I said, yes, sir. But I said, I have a wife and child and I have to earn a living. But have I not done a decent job while I've been here? Well, he said, I must admit you have done that. So go on. Go back to the bench, he said.
What were you doing then, Joe?
I was a fitter at De Havilland's.
Where was De Havilland's at that time?
At Hatfield.
At Hatfield?
Yes. And we were did a lot of work on the prototype for the mosquito. And of course, this was at the time when the war broke out, we all joined the local defence volunteers, which was what they called it before the Home Guard was formed. And on the local defence volunteers, we used to quite frequently have to go down to Salisbury Hall, where we acted as guards. And of course it was at Salisbury Hall where the prototype mosquito was being built.
Did you follow the events leading to the war in Europe? You know, the rise of Hitler and fascism.
I didn't know. No, I was not the least bit political. Of course I followed it once it was announced that there was going to be a war, etc., etc. And the reason I volunteered for the Air Force was, as a Class A fitter, I was a reserved occupation. And when my wife's brother came out of Dunkirk and I heard some of the stories that had happened there, I felt almost ashamed that I should be in a reserved occupation and not out there doing my little bit. But the only thing, I volunteered as an air gunner, but I wasn't allowed to do that. I didn't think I could possibly become a pilot or a navigator. Those days, in my young days, if you saw a pilot walking along, he was like some god. You almost followed him from street to street, especially when you saw an aeroplane guy, and you say, of course, we'd be shouting, aeroplane, aeroplane, and run from street to street to keep it in sight. But you thought that a pilot was some sort of god. We found out afterwards, of course, after a while, that any ordinary individual could become a pilot. But I volunteered, and
you say you wanted to be an air gunner.
Yes, but you weren't allowed to be an air gunner. That wasn't you as a reserved occupation. You had to either be a pilot or a navigator. I didn't fancy being a navigator. I wanted the action, so I volunteered to be a pilot. And then I had this interview, and I was told my educational qualifications weren't sufficient. And they gave me, I always remember it, they gave me a little chit which said what you should or what you shouldn't know. And one of the little things that was on it was transposition of formula. I didn't know what the hell transposition of formula was until I asked a friend of mine at De Havilland, who was a little, left school later than I, and he said, well, it's just taking the figure over to the other side of the equation and changing the sign. Put like that, I could understand it, but transposition of formula, I didn't. However, I applied later on, and they'd either lowered their standard or they'd lost so many, perhaps, that they accepted me.
And did you have special tests to become a pilot? Did they give you special aptitude tests?
No tests whatsoever. They, I was put on a reserve for a while until I would then got my call-up papers. And I remember the call-up paper very, very well, because I was due to, I belonged to the De Havilland Rifle Association. I was on their shooting team, as a matter of fact, rifle team. And we had a match that night. But in the afternoon, when I'd got told that I was called up, and So I went over with friends of mine over to the Comet pub and had a little more drink than I should have. When I went to get down, lay down into the rifle butts and put my eye to the foresight, we had a six hole of various diameters, and I used to fire through the very finest one, but I couldn't even see through the biggest one. And all I did notice that the foresight, the cover of the foresight, fitted squarely round the target. And I fired and got a 94, which was well below my 98 average, 94, having never seen the bullseye. But anyway, that was quite an interesting thing.
At that time, Joe, you mentioned you were married, and this was to...
Oh, I married long before the war.
Did you have any children?
Yes, we had two children.
No.
We had two children before we went to Hatfield. We had two children before we went to Hatfield.
Very fun.
Didn't we?
No. James born 1940. James born 1940.
Yeah.
And the Havens was in Hatfield.
Yeah.
As you said, in Diggs. It's
yeah.
Morford.
Yeah. But before we went and lived at Hatfield, we had two children, Pat and Jean.
Yeah. Anyway, you had a family. That's the important thing.
Yeah.
You were, a married man with a family.
That's right.
Volunteering when you didn't have to, really.
That's right.
Yes.
But then why should other people fight for my children?
Is that how you felt?
That's how I felt,
yes.
Yeah. I was more entitled to fight than someone who wasn't married. Anyway, I went to normal Aircrew Association at